Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the stars and the night sky and learn about a little bit more about the Astronomy Learning Center, known as the UW Space Place. It'll be shuttered soon, and that doesn't mean there aren't opportunities to learn about kind of what lies beyond our world and our solar system. And who better to talk about it than Jim Lattice, former retired as director of the UW Space Place, former manager of the Washburn Observatory, faculty associate in astronomy with the UW-Madison College of Letters and Science. And as we talk with Jim, I hope you will join in. Want to know where to maybe aim your telescope and when? Questions about telescopes, questions about the space place. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Jim Lattice, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's really nice to be back.
So the space place is going to be closing in June. And on going for a while.
Well, yes, certainly by June. We've been sort of ramping things down to, we have to actually be moved out in June.
Okay.
So we've been more or less closed. We had to shut down most of our programming when my colleague and I retired at about the same time, and the university was not, there's a hiring freeze, and they couldn't hire new staff. So the programming more or less stopped, except that we have some energetic student volunteers who've been doing Saturday programs and things like that down there. So we have been trying just in the last few weeks to schedule some, in effect, open house times. Basically, I've been opening the place up and hosting so that people can come in and see our exhibits and talk about the place and have a chance to see it before the before it starts really getting packed up and closed out.
Yeah, I'm thinking about packing up. Do you have there are some historic artifacts and exhibits. I've always loved those. And enjoyed my times there, visiting there for sure.
Yeah, we have stuff going from the earliest days of astronomy on the UW campus, right on up to the things that we built to fly on the Hubble Space Telescope and things like that.
So, what's to become of all of that?
Well, I'm not really. We actually have a pretty good solution for most of it, which I can't actually announce just yet.
Yeah.
But just last week. We got it firmed up. It's going to be in good hands, and it's still going to be available to the people of Wisconsin, I think, for the most part, most of the historic items there. We do have a couple that we're still looking for appropriate homes for, and it's kind of a short fuse sort of at this point. But we're actively working on those. So most of it will have a good home. And I'm certainly pleased about that, but it's taken us the last 6 months to find a suitable home for it. And I think we'll probably announce that pretty soon as everybody is on the same page with that.
What memories will you cherish of the space place? I mean, there's got to be so many.
Right. Yeah, we've been doing that for so many years that it's hard to single out things. We've had plenty of wonderful events and things there when there's some astronomical event happening. But some of them we used to do just virtually when it was cloudy outside. People could sit in our auditorium and watch something happening on the screen. But the real good stuff was when we had lots of people looking through telescopes at things. So one of my favorites was the transit of Venus in
2008.
Something like that. Yeah, and that was a day when it was kind of partly cloudy here. So we've got telescopes set up with solar filters and things like that out in the parking lot. And there was this enormous suspense because just occasionally the clouds would part a little bit and you'd see the sun and you'd see Venus, the shadow of Venus right there on the surface. And you could just hear a ripple go through the crowd. Oh, it's there. And then people would come over to the telescopes. And then it would, of course, cloud over again. So that happened then over and over again during the course of the event out there. And it was, I mean, you know, it would have been nicer to have a perfectly clear day, but it really highlighted people's interest and enthusiasm, that tension, you know, that that desire to see this remarkable event that we're not going to see again in our lifetimes. So it was things like that, the actual astronomical events that we put on that are my favorites, I think.
Yeah. Did you ever do like telescope production, or I thought you had programs for children that were always fun.
We did, yeah. You know, so we were always looking for ways. Telescopes are actually kind of a tricky problem, but there were two things that worked out particularly well. Years ago, we got a little grant from NASA that allowed us to buy telescope kits that were actually fairly substantial telescopes, respectable telescopes. And we didn't have any good programming for middle and high school students, I didn't feel like. And so we created this program where we partnered with a number of middle schools and high schools, and the NASA money basically supplied the telescope kits so we could buy these telescope kits. They were 3.5-inch Newtonian reflectors, not little handheld things. And then we would build them with the students and the at their school, and then we would help them put on a star party after they had built their telescopes, you know. And one of my favorite moments there is we're at one of these star parties at the school, and I don't remember what it was. It's probably Jupiter, or maybe it's just the moon or something. But some dad looks through there and then looks over at me and says, "My kid built this?" I said, "Yeah, that's isn't that great?" there were lots of things like that where people are learning not just what you see through a telescope, but, you know, the value of having something like that, the motivation of looking at something like that, especially when it's unexpected like that. Kind of like the transit of Venus there, too.
Yeah.
But then we also had, there was also that great program called Galileoscope. And it's a real pity that didn't really take off. But those are little telescopes, but still respectable telescopes. And SpacePlace was one of the biggest distributors of those while they were still being produced. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of them. We used to have workshops for schools and for the public as well. And they were cheap as telescopes go. You could come in and buy a telescope. We had some grants to provide them to some schools and, again, do like workshops with science classes and things like
that.
My
daughter got one of those.
Did she?
Still in operation.
Still got it? Oh, okay, yeah.
Still in operation. Oh, man. I think you said there's still some opportunities to visit the space place, or are, yeah, there's some events?
Right. There. We have one more. I announced a few couple of weeks ago, and Saturday, what's this? Is this Saturday? Is that the 4th?
Yeah, April 4th.
Yeah. Right. That's the next one that we have scheduled, and then I hope to schedule some other ones later in April. I don't have those. I haven't set any dates yet on those. But, yeah, we'll be down there. We'll just open the doors on Saturday from 11 until 3, I think, were the hours I announced. So people can just drop in, and no particular program, just come and go as they like.
Yeah.
And then we'll, I'll try to schedule a couple more of those as schedules permit.
And people can go to the sites there, UW Space Place?
Yes. You can go to, it's actually, we moved the website. It's it's spaceplace.astro.wisc.edu is now okay. The website. Which is a little different than we used to.
Yeah, spaceplace.astro.wisc.edu.
Wisc.edu.
Yeah. We can put that up on our...
Sure.
We'll put that up on our program notes for today's program, so people, if they want to take a look, they can do.
Sure.
Well, let's... somebody was wondering about the moon...
The moon mission?
The moon mission.
Yeah, the Artemis II.
The Artemis II, and you know a little about that, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, I'm not a space flight expert or anything, but I've certainly been following that. Yeah, that's pretty exciting. So you know, if they get that thing off the ground, and the Artemis 1, the spacecraft which was unmanned, when was that? 2023, a few years ago, There were issues, which is why it's now been 3 years since they relaunched. Yeah. But generally speaking, it worked really well. That was that first launch of that new big rocket that kind of replaces the Saturn, the old Saturn V from the Apollo days. They're going to fly. They're going to go into Earth orbit first for a bunch of testing, but then they're actually going to try out the engines that take them to the moon, and they're going to go out and swing around the moon. I think they call it a free return. You get on such a path that even if your engine fails at that point, the moon slings you around and sends you back to the Earth. So that's a relatively safe
option.
Kind
of a figure eight, it looked like to me.
That's what it looks like, yeah, if you draw it in the right frame of reference. Yeah, it looks like they cross their path and come back. All those things are moving around, so it depends on just how you draw the path. They're going to fly around the moon there, and that'll be the first time human beings have done that since the Apollo program, Apollo 17, whatever that was.
And probably a 72. Precursor to the next one landing?
Well, that's, of course, the plan, yeah. So they have two, this is all about landing, ultimately, on the moon. The big difference here between the Apollo program, when the Saturn V launched astronauts to the moon, they had their lander with them, all in one launch. And so they would land. Everybody remembers that little the lunar module with the legs and the shiny gold foil, and it sits down on the moon. The Artemis is not carrying that. The lander is supposed to go separately and be there, meet the astronauts when they get to the moon. And so there are two companies that have contracts to build lunar landers that go with the Artemis program. One is SpaceX and the other is Blue Horizons, the Jeff Bezos company.
Yeah.
And so I haven't looked into that just lately. At least the SpaceX one has encountered a lot of delays in their development of a lander. So that's a really, really big departure from the Apollo. you get a separate company to contract a completely separate spacecraft that meets you there, and that's on them to get that in line. So that will, until one of those landers is ready to go, there won't be any actual landing on the moon.
Yeah, so the lander. Well, I don't want to get into the. So a lander would land, and then you had to hit the lander.
Well. So they would rendezvous in lunar orbit.
I see. Yeah, was going to say.
Yeah. So they would dock in lunar orbit with the separately launched lunar lander, right? And then they land on the moon, and they then they get back into orbit, lunar orbit again, transfer back to the space cap, the command module of the Artemis, and then and come back. And I guess the lander comes back. I'm not really sure
how that's going to happen, but
I guess it comes. I think the idea is it comes back to Earth and gets refueled there, and then you use it for the next mission. But
it's pretty cool. There's no doubt about that.
it is really cool. Yeah, it's the technology. Some of the technologies have changed so much since the Apollo days that a lot of the stuff should be a lot slicker than we were able to do back then.
Jim Lattice, our guest today, retired as director of the UW Space Place. And, you know, we're going to turn our attention now to some of the planets and the constellation, what's going on in the night sky with him. And you can join in. I hope you do. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look now at the night sky with Jim Lattice of the UW Space Place, former director of the Space Place, retired, former manager of the Washburn Observatory, and he's been a guest How many years have you been on this program, Jim?
Well, not sure. It's been a few years.
It's been 25 years, probably.
Yeah, that's probably about right.
That's probably about right. Kate and Nina has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Kate.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Dr. Lattice.
Morning.
I do have a question. I retired from UW Oshkosh, and while there, I was good friends with Jennifer. And the one thing I really miss about not being connected with the university anymore is having knowledgeable current people give me hints and clues about what's coming up that I should be watching for in the sky. So do you have any recommendations on spring and summer for what I should be watching for in the sky from my backyard?
Sure. Thank you for that. It is something that you have to sort of keep up with. And I'll tell you what I do just in general is I subscribe to Sky and Telescope magazine, and another good one is Astronomy magazine. And either one of those will keep you. They both come out several months ahead. I think I was just reading the May issue of Sky and Telescope. And then there are a few other really good sources. There's something called the Astronomical Calendar by a guy named Guy Ottewell that you can get online. I think you can still buy his printed edition, too. So those are really good information sources. On a shorter term, things like both Sky and Telescope and Astronomy have good websites, and you don't have to be a subscriber to use a lot of those things. There's a couple of really good NASA sites. One of the ones that I check regularly is something called spaceweather.com, which is largely oriented to solar activity. But they note lots of upcoming astronomical events too, one of which that maybe we'll get a chance to talk about here, a possible nova this summer. And, I'm keeping track of that by keeping track of space weather. As far as what's coming up this spring, we actually have, we still have Jupiter in the evening sky, still high up there. And so if you're looking for something to point your telescope at, that's going to be still a good alternative for some time going on into the spring. And then we're also going to have, though, Venus rising higher. Venus is above the horizon just a little bit now. Just after sunset at twilight, but it goes down kind of early, but it's going to be more prominent, as we go into the spring. Those are sort of the planet things to look for. It sort of depends on whether you're thinking of, telescopic observing or just general stargazing, but spring is a really good time for, stargazing. There's a configuration that happens around in the spring, which is that during the early hours of the night, the Milky Way is almost invisible because it ends up being oriented all around the horizon. So you really don't see it. So the sky overhead, if you've got a dark sky, then the sky overhead on a moonless night is especially dark. And there are lots of interesting, certainly constellations, lots of interesting objects up there that are good for your telescope, including just some nice double stars that are really easy to catch. As far as actual events go, there aren't any really good meteor showers until the end of summer, until the Perseids, at least in my trying to winnow them out. There's lots of minor meteor showers that are coming along on and off all the time. But the next good one is really not until August. There are a couple of things you can keep. Going back to space weather, there's a couple of possible bright comets that we might see that might just be visible in the early morning sky. Might be a naked eye visible, those are good options for, say, binoculars if that's kind of your style of astronomical observing rather than a telescope. And binoculars, don't underestimate them. I would just say, make that general comment that they're most people have access to some. They don't have to be special astronomy binoculars, but taking those out on a on a moonless night and exploring some of the star clusters in the springtime sky high overhead, a really good way to make some plans for that is to use a free piece of software called Stellarium that you can download from stellarium.org. And there's also a mobile version of it, too. And so if you were to set it up for one of these spring nights, say, we'll just say it's sort of the end of April, maybe when things are warming up a little bit, and set it for the time that you want to be outside, software like that will highlight interesting objects for you. And then you can use your binoculars, say, to look at some beautiful star clusters and things like that. So that's kind of, in general, that would be my suggestion.
Yeah. There's the, what is it, spring Lyrids meteor shower?
Yeah, right.
We're not going to see much of that.
My recollection is that the moon is not cooperating for that one.
It's about 27% full during that time period.
Yeah, so the evening, 27% full. You mean on, what is the phase of the moon then? What's the date for that peak?
April 14th to April 30th. The peak is April 21st to 22nd.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So that's the waning. That's the waning moon. It'll be up in the early morning, in the early morning hours. So that's that. Not a reason you shouldn't go look for Lyrid meteors if you're looking for a meteor shower, but the moon will diminish. The best viewing time is early in the morning, but the pre-dawn hours, and that's when the moon will be interfering there.
I think the most fun time I had watching meteor showers was in Tucson, Arizona, at a friend's place. And Tucson is kind of more of a dark city.
Yeah.
Yeah, they keep their lights off and in the evenings. And we sat in a friend's hot tub. Four of us just sort of lead back and, oh, there's one, and there's one. It was really a lot. It was later. It was in the summer.
Oh, yeah, that would be nice. Right. Tucson is one of the best cities and that have taken control of that kind of the light pollution. And even then, there's still plenty of it out there. But they've been doing that for a long time because of the proximity of the big observatories to them out there. Yeah, one of my favorite the Leonids, when the Leonids were really active about 20 years ago, I had the opportunity to sit on a nice beach in the Caribbean.
Oh,
and they were that was really just really great. Just a lawn chair sitting on the sand and gazing up into the sky. Boy, that was great.
Oh man, Jim Lattice, our guest today. We're talking about the night sky and the planets with him. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Jamie in Algoma. Jamie, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I was wondering if your guest knows anything about the big meteor that a lot of people saw and captured last Tuesday, March 24th. I was driving back from Sheboygan to Green Bay about 8:30, and this giant orange ball streaked, seemed like southwest to northeast across the sky, and I guess a lot of people caught it on the Ring doorbells.
So where were you when you saw this?
I was on Highway 43, probably around Manitowoc, driving north.
Wow. I had not heard about that one. That's really interesting. It's not unusual. In fact, there's usually probably a few a day bright, what we often call fireball meteors, and that sounds like a classic case. Most of them don't get observed because they have to come in over a populated area where the sky is not cloudy and things like that. So I hadn't heard about that one, but there has been a little peak of fireballs because we're not very far past the vernal equinox. Well, I shouldn't say because. We don't really know why, but it seems that around the vernal equinox, the frequency of reported fireballs goes up.
Hmm.
There's a peak there, and there's debate in the scientific community about what might be going on there. It doesn't happen at the autumnal equinox 6 months later, so it's not an equinox sort of thing. At least it doesn't seem like it. It may be that the Earth is always in the same part of its orbit at that time of year. And it may be this just by chance that it's near the equinox that several meteor swarms come closest to Earth, maybe cross the plane of Earth's orbit at that place. But that's, I didn't even know about this phenomenon until a few weeks ago. I was reading about it, about this peak, which is then needs an explanation. So it sounds like you saw one of those. It sounds like you saw one of the ones from the vernal equinox fireball peak.
That's pretty cool, Jamie. I wonder if anybody else has seen saw that same thing. It was on March 24th, so there may be others. If you didn't, give a call. Let's hear about it.
Yeah, something like that at night, lots of people see those because they really catch your attention if it's dark and you get this flash in the sky. If the sky's bright, then usually only people who are looking in just the right direction, or now these days the doorbells that are always looking out.
Well, and and a lot of those are pretty darn small,
well,
aren't they?
Relatively speaking, yeah. So, I mean, a fireball meteor is going to have something that, say, you can see in the daytime. That's going to be a pretty substantial piece of rock.
Okay.
You know, something, I don't know, it could be the size of a basketball or something like that. The typical, what we commonly call falling stars, the things that you see typically in a meteor shower or just the sporadics that we see in between meteor showers, those are typically very small particles. But there's a whole lot of energy when they reach the Earth's atmosphere. They're going really fast because it's the collision of the Earth and this particle. And so whatever the resultant velocity between their two orbits are, they come in with a lot of energy. So even a tiny thing, a grain of sand or a small pebble, something, a pea-sized thing would be a bright meteor. Those things burn up, you know, 50 miles over our heads, and we'll still see them. So that's a lot of energy. But yeah, those are tiny particles.
Jim Lattice, our guest today of the UW-Madison Space Place. Great to have him with us. And again, you can join in at 800-642-1234. I paused a second there because I flashed on my yesterday's show. We were interviewing the author of A Short History of the World. And we were talking about the tilt of the Earth. Hmm. And the suspicion was, well, pretty good suspicion, I guess, that a very large asteroid hit the Earth and actually knocked it off its tilt.
Right.
And created the moon.
Right. Yeah, that'd be very early on. That's right. Yeah.
Millions and billions of years ago.
That's the current best accepted theory for the formation of the moon is a massive collision of, really, people talk about two planets. They're more planet-sized than asteroid-sized from that collision. That hypothetical collision, but that seems to match the evidence best, which, by the way, was almost a direct result of the samples that the Apollo missions brought back. The actual chemical analysis of those things ruled out some other theories and brought the collision theory sort of to the into prominence for that. But you can't just keep on invoking hypothetical cosmic collisions ever. I mean, Mars has an axial tilt, roughly the same, within a half degree or so, of the Earth's axial tilt.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen anybody say, well, there has to be a massive collision. There could easily have been that didn't form a massive moon around Mars. But anyway, this one is fairly well accepted and, might have produced the tip in the Earth's axis.
And our seasons.
Oh, of course, right. That's a direct result then, of the seasons, is that we get Mars gets seasons for the same reason. In fact, most of the planets have some sort of substantial tilt that makes not all as much as that, but that makes, or some more that makes for a big difference in the way the solar energy is absorbed on the planet as it orbits around the sun, creates interesting weather patterns, but very important for us, of course.
Kim in Eau Claire, we'll go to you. Hi, Kim. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for the program. So this winter, we were all the way over on the west coast in Inglewood, and when they launched an Atlas the nine rocket, I was able to videotape it from that distance to see that rocket go up.
It was
amazing.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Those are if you catch one of those at just the right time. What time of day was that?
It was not day. It was night because it's 125 miles away.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all the way over on the other side.
Yeah.
But and then also with the meteor, one winter we were out in the country and from horizon to horizon, I saw this meteor going across and trail and just debris particles breaking off as it was coming into the atmosphere. It was something else. It was in January.
Yeah. When those things, the ones I was reading about, so that's interesting. The one near Manitowoc is a new one for me, but there were a couple of those where there were fragments. Meteorite hunters were out right away after these things were sighted, checking for fragments of it. Yeah, it's very common to see them fragmenting. It's a lot harder to find those fragments when they finally get scattered out around on the ground. Those rocket launches have become quite a great sight. And the reason I asked about time of day is that when they happen around twilight, then you get all kinds of interesting solar illumination of the vapor trail and whatever they produce that can look pretty unusual. You've never seen anything like that before because you've never been in the right place when a rocket gets launched and the illumination angle is just right and everything. But that's more and more common to see those things. And then in addition, we have the SpaceX launches that launch these payloads of a few dozen satellites at a time. And then in the succeeding days, again, right around twilight is the best time to catch those. And then you get these string of pearls, they call them. A lot of that stuff happening in space these days produces sights that nobody would ever have seen.
Yeah.
Nobody would ever have seen before.
Kim, thanks for those experiences. Appreciate it very much. Vern and Boyd called to say he believes that if you leave a telescopic camera on overnight for 8 to 12 hours, the sky will appear white. And he wonders if that's the case.
Depends on how you set up your camera, I think. You can certainly, overexpose a camera on skylight if it's. I'm not entirely sure what we're talking about here. If we mean like a cell phone camera or something along that line, that would be one thing. Usually, astronomical cameras don't see the whole sky.
I would think it. I was looking into this a little bit. It could be caused by dew or frost condensing.
Of course that could happen too, and that then picks up scattered light in the environment. That's not then the skylight, but you'd be getting light scattered around from other sources. Yeah, well, that's a good one on me. I don't know without knowing, what camera and just what the circumstances were. It's kind of hard to say.
Jim Lattice, our guest. Questions for him? Give a call. The number 800-642-1234. You could email thetalk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we take a look at the night sky with our guest, Jim Lattice, who's retired from the UW-Madison Space Place. At noon today, we'll talk about the UW-Madison's women's hockey team winning its ninth NCAA national championship. Assistant coach Jackie Crum joins us. And then at 12:30, we'll take a look at jury duty. Have you ever been a part of jury duty? And one more thing, I'm taking a tour around the state before I retire at the end of June, and I'd love to see you. We'll be in Wausau tomorrow night, actually, at the Veninga Theater in Eau Claire. I think that's sold out, but there may be, in fact, I'm sure it is, but there are extra tickets that you might still be able to get. On April 21st, I'll be at the Pablo Center in Green Bay, and on May 12th, I'll be at the Widener Center, and finally in Madison on June 3rd, I'll be at the Barrymore Theater.
Wow.
And I'll be, and all of those will be doing a short interview with Jill, and then we'll take audience questions. It's all free, but we'd like you to secure your seat, and you can register at WPR.org/presents. Looking forward to tomorrow night. We'll see how that goes. And the Barrymore Theater, that's going to be a real trick for me, because it's going to take me a good 4 minutes to get from my home to the Barrymore Theater. I won't be needing to put in any requests for gas. Oh, boy. Yeah, let's go back to stars here. Kevin and Madison, what's on your mind?
Yes, I have a question. I've enjoyed doing nighttime photography, but I've been doing more or less the single shot approach, getting the right lens, the right light, all of those factors together. But I'm curious about what success I would get with methods where they take hundreds and hundreds of shots at the same thing with a very, very high noisy ISO, and then you use digital correction to keep only what's constant across the photos. And with that, I'd just sort of like to take the response offline. Are they doing something similar with more commercial or heavy grade nighttime telescopic lenses doing digital correction or optical correction? I'd like to understand what's going on there.
Okay, sure. Well, let's see. So you're talking about they often call it lucky imaging, where you take lots of images and pick the good ones and stack those up. And process them, and that doesn't take it's more the software that you have to have available to work on those images. You can do it with relatively simple cameras. We did it back in I was just there, but what was that up at Washburn Observatory? There was a shadow transit of Titan, the moon of Saturn. And it was not a great night, but one of the guys who's really good at this from the Madison Astronomical Society took a bunch of images while we were there. And then a week later, after he's worked them over, he sends around this beautiful image. It was better than pretty much any of us saw through the telescope. So there is some expertise on that. I'm a strong advocate of getting involved with the Madison Astronomical Society. If you're anywhere near Madison.
Yeah, he's in Madison.
Okay, so. Yeah. So there are experts there in the club. Their website is madisonastro.org. I think I'm getting that right. And there's an enormous amount of expertise in that group, and they're all happy to share their experience and help people get started in that. So that's a really good. They meet every the second Friday of every month, and they have for about 25 years met at Space Place, but they're shifting their meeting place to Memorial High School. That is going to host them out there for their monthly meetings. So I'm sure that's noted on their website, or will be at a certain point. The last meeting though is going to be in May at Space Place, second Friday in May. Well, and then the second Friday in April is going to come up too. But that would be my suggestion. Aside from there's plenty of good places to learn about that on the internet and things like that. But it's really better to talk to people who have the experience and can evaluate the equipment that you have available and what you can do with it.
And you can probably post a question even on the. And what's the site again? It's Madison.
Madison Astro, all one word, .org.
.org.
Yeah, that's the Madison Astronomical Society. It's a great, great club. They're going to encourage you to join, but the meetings are open to the public, and you're welcome to just. Show up, and I'm often there too. And we all, it's great. You have this, people all come to things from different angles and different expertise and things like that. And clubs like that are great. So since you're in Madison, that would be my recommendation for getting started on that.
Kevin, thank you for calling. I had an email from Gene. Gene emailed to say that lightning on Jupiter will be visible tonight. Train airline.
Okay. They do occasionally spot that. I don't think you can see that in a telescope. I've never seen that in a telescope, but maybe the maybe the Hubble or something.
Maybe the Hubble will be on. Can you look through the Hubble? I mean, we can't go to some screen that shows what the Hubble's seeing.
No, it doesn't work that way. Although anybody can submit an observing proposal. Like you say, I'd love to photograph the lightning on Jupiter. You can make a proposal, and it gets evaluated by a panel of astronomers who rank these things because the time on that is precious. Everybody would love to have time. All the astronomers would love to have time on that. And then they evaluate those things. So the chances of one of us just coming from out here and getting a proposal approved is pretty small, but in theory that's open to the public. But no, there's no live stream check to see what they're looking at.
Too bad. Yeah. Mike in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Thanks for the show. It's a good one. The Wolf Moon in January. The Native Americans talked about that. It's the brightest moon in January. It's the first moon, full moon in January. I wanted to get a picture of it, so I stepped out on my stoop here in Madison on the west side, and I saw it. It's really, really bright, and so I took a picture of it with my cell phone. And when I put the cell phone down in front of me, and I looked at it, and there's a green something to green to the right of it. Now the moon was due west, and so I got my phone back up and I enlarged it just a tad bit, and I took another picture, and the green thing had moved to the left, which would be to the south. And I don't know what that was, but it was a green. Somebody told me it was a green orb that pilots see them a fair amount of the time. I don't know if that's true or not.
Huh.
Well, that's a new one. That's a new one for me. Did you zoom back out again and try to take the image again to see whether the image went back to where
it absolutely disappeared?
It had disappeared. It didn't come back. Yeah.
It disappeared. Okay. It was in two locations. I have it on my cell phone. I show it to some friends, and they check the crazy box on me.
Well, I mean, I don't know how. Compared to the image of the moon, how big was it?
The first one, it was about a third of the size. The second picture was half the size.
Huh. So it's maybe like moving away.
Yeah. Nope, you got me. I didn't know that pilots see green orbs all the time either. So I'm not sure what you've got there. My first guess would have been a reflection in the lens because that happens very easily. But if it didn't come back when you recreate it, if you zoom back out again, then it's probably not a reflection. I'm stumped. That sounds interesting.
Maybe somebody else has got a thought on the green orb, Mike, so stay listening. Let's go to Greg and Saner. Greg, hi.
Gentlemen, good day. Hey, I would like your guests' thoughts on the what appears to be increased intensity of solar flares. And if the intense solar flares are capable of an electromagnetic pulse, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
So we are near solar maximum, so there is a regular cycle in the strength and frequency of things like solar flares that has a real rough period of about 11 years or so. And so 5 or so years ago, the sun was pretty quiet. I rarely saw a sunspot, rarely saw a solar flare or anything. But now they're popping off pretty frequently. And there have been a couple of really strong ones just in the last few weeks. And if it follows the normal pattern, then in the next 6 months to a year, it's going to taper off. We should be near the peak and it'll decrease. So there have been some really powerful solar flares that can have really strong effects on the Earth. If you're interested in the subject, there was one in 1850, I'm going to probably get the year wrong here, 57 or 58, but something called the Carrington Event. There's a really good book about that called The Sun King or Sun Kings. I don't remember the author. That had effects on the Earth in the early days of telegraph communications. Before that, such a flare would have had almost no effect on the Earth. But we're even more vulnerable to those sorts of things now, as are all the satellites in orbit. So not exactly an electromagnetic pulse in the way that term is usually used, but it definitely can, it creates magnetic disturbances and electrical disturbances on the Earth. So if those things, if one were to connect just at the right time, it depends on the just how they intersect with the Earth. And they don't always. In fact, most of them, there was a really strong one just the other day, but it was over on the edge of the sun, and so its effects kind of went off in a different direction. Astronomers could see the flare happen, but there no nothing nothing to affect the Earth in that case. But whether there's a longer-term increase in the strength of solar flares would be hard to say, because we don't really have a good baseline over very many solar cycles for that kind of thing. What we really have are sunspot counts over a few centuries. But measuring the strength of solar flares is not something that's been done consistently, except maybe in the past, I don't know, the past few solar cycles. So long-term trends are harder to
come by,
harder to establish.
Greg, thank you. Michael emailed to say, one summer as a child, he saw the northern sky turned orange in the early evening. This was near Chicago. And when he returned home, the evening news said it was due to a rare astronomical event. And now he can't remember what the event was called.
Oh, dear.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, that's if it was an most people would not call say auroras like the aurora borealis, the northern lights, an astronomical event, at least not these days, although they are connected to solar activity and solar flares. If it wasn't a strong aurora, then I don't know what it might have been. We'd have to dig into some newspaper reports and try to see what that might have been.
In the last minute or so, the blaze star explosion is expected soon.
We've been saying that since 2024. this is a fascinating thing. This is a what they call a recurrent nova. This star explodes. It's really two stars. It's a star system where one star dumps matter onto its companion, and when enough of that accumulates, the companion explodes all of that gas. It doesn't destroy the star, but there's an outburst. It gets thousands, many thousands of times brighter than it is right now, which is pretty dim. But it brightens it up enough that we can see it by eye. So this has been observed roughly every 80 years for the past two or three cycles.
Yeah.
But how do you predict another one? The astronomers have had various models for how this works and what that means for when it's going to pop off the next time. And the models predicting 2024 were wrong, it turns out. And the models predicting 2025 were wrong. So now there's another one, though, predicting June this year. So one of these models is going to be right. And so
I predict if it doesn't happen this year in June, it'll happen next year in June.
That's right.
That's the Mueller prediction.
We'll get you on record there so you can claim that. Yeah. But something to watch for. Spaceweather.com is a good place to keep checking for that. But you have to keep checking because when it happens, the sky brightens up to. The star brightens up quite nicely. It's in the nice summer sky in the constellation Corona Borealis. It brightens up to second magnitude or so, which is about the brightness of the North Star. So a prominent, the brightest, but a prominent star. But it probably will only last a couple of days. So you need to know that it's happened and then get out there that night to get a look at it. And then once it's gone by, it'll be another 80-odd years until
we won't be around for that one.
Yeah. Enjoy it this time.
Boy. And speaking of enjoying, I always enjoy talking with you, Jim. Thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure, Larry.
Jim Lattice, former director, retired as director of the UW Space Place. It's been great to talk with him about the Space Place and about the night sky, and hopefully we can do that again with him down the road. Coming up, we're going to talk with Jackie Crum, the assistant coach of the UW-Madison's National Championship Hockey Team. That next, I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. We are turning our attention to the UW women's hockey team. Saw a wonderful editorial in the Wisconsin State Journal. I don't know if our guests saw it, but the other day, maybe it was a day or two ago, and Jackie Crum, our guest, by the way, she is the assistant coach of UW-Madison's women's hockey team, a former player, and she has been with the team for a long time. And I want to talk with her about the team itself. We can maybe review the championship game a little bit, but also talk about what makes this team so successful year in and year out. And I hope you'll join in. Are you a fan? Do you like watching women's hockey? I do. I think it's great fun. And join in with your thoughts and comments as we move along. The number to call, 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@wpr.org. Jackie Crum, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You did not see, or did you see that Wisconsin State Journal?
No, I'll be totally honest. I do not get the newspaper, so I missed it. I mean, obviously, I could subscribe online, but I haven't had time to read everything yet.
You should go back. And part of it says, say it loud and proud, Wisconsin dominates women's hockey. Not Minnesota,
awesome.
Not Ohio State or Penn State, not the Ivy League. Wisconsin is the undisputed number one.
Sounds great to me. Yeah.
It's their main editorial. I think it was yesterday.
Wow.
It just happened. And here we are, March 22nd, the Badger women's hockey team became the nine-time national champion after, what a nail-biter. You drove me nuts out there, Jackie. There were times it was so tense, I literally had to just turn away. What's it like as a coach? I mean, a game, you're playing for the national championship. What do you feel like as a coach going into that game and during that game?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure every coach is different, but I attribute it's kind of like being a player. I mean, I think every coach has a bit of nerves, excitement. I do think a thing that we have is we've been in the championship game quite a few times. So we have the experience of like the feelings that you get and just the magnitude of the game and the intensity and, the swing of the game, the momentum shifts and what that looks like. And so you kind of know it's coming when you're in these games. And, we've had such close games with Ohio and it's only been decided by one goal in these crazy situations. So, you know, a wild game is coming. And it's just a matter of, trying to keep it collective and, calm as you can for the players on the bench, because they're nervous as well. I mean, a lot of them have been in it before, but it's still, you're still nervous.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. You are indeed. What were the highlights for you of that final matchup? I mean, for me, I thought, oh, they're up 2-0. Even then, I was sitting there on the edge of my chair watching.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, highlights, I mean, just because you're up 2-0, I mean, you're never home free in any hockey game, and two-goal lead isn't that much in hockey, and so Ohio has such a talented team that you know they can score, and they can make a comeback, and that's what they tried to do. So I think a highlight for me is just how well our team stuck together in that situation. And, there was a momentum shift to Ohio, and they kind of were pushing, and we were able to push back. And obviously, I was pretty excited for, somebody like Claire Enright to score the game-winning goal, who's just a tremendous human being and just the epitome of a team player and probably one of our most defensively sound forwards. So to have her have that reward of scoring the game-winning goal is awesome. And to obviously Ava, our goalie, just stood on her head for us and was calm and collective in these intense situations. And so, yeah, that's definitely something that I'll remember.
Yeah, I can believe that. The State Journal talked about the coaching, you as coaches and in that editorial, and he talked about Mark Johnson, the head coach, and he gets the best out of his players with cool confidence, they were saying. He doesn't have to yell or make a scene from the bench. He wins again and again by teaching his players to play as a team and then giving them freedom to be creative. How mm-hmm. how accurate would you say? I think it's pretty accurate, but what do you think?
Yeah. I would say that's accurate, 100%. That's definitely how he coaches, how we all coach, you know, what we try and instill in our players. And I don't know if they said it in the article, but our big theme this year was, you know, it's not about you, it's about us. And so what can we do, you know, to make it about us? And every decision that we make is team driven. And it's not individual player driven. It's how can we win as a team? And so that was the big message this year.
It's pretty cool. And the team included four players who won Olympic gold. I was at one of the games at the Le Mans when they weren't there. The most recent one, I think, when they weren't there, they actually lost that game by a goal, but that was on a Saturday game. But the does something like that hurt? You know, when you suddenly you lose. Obviously, these are four of the best players.
Yeah, so we actually lost five.
I know.
The Czech player was gone too. So
right.
we've never experienced this before, because usually there's a, you know, it's a Olympic year and the players go away for the year and then they come back. So it was new territory for not only us, but, you know, all other teams in the league that had international players that played on their Olympic teams. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously it hurts us, but also it was a really cool experience to see all the players that were here step up into roles that maybe they weren't in before and own it and play their best hockey. And I mean, obviously they're cheering for their teammates in the Olympics, but life goes on in Wisconsin here, and we still have a league, you know, a season to finish out, and we want to win the regular season championship, which we did. And it was, you know, kudos to those players for stepping up while they were gone and continuing that on. So we just didn't miss a beat, and it was really cool.
Yeah, and there you had one player who didn't quite make the Olympic team, and she, I think, took on a big role to keep the team together.
Mm-hmm. I'm assuming you're talking about Lacey Eden.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no. So obviously, you know, just devastation for her for not making the team. But, you know, it was, you know, from our standpoint, pretty beneficial to have her back here in Wisconsin. And she's just a tremendous player. And so to have her on the ice, and, you know, she was an assistant, and, you know, we made her a captain as well. And she just, you know, helped, you know, bring the team together and basically put the team on her shoulders and had an outstanding February. And, I will say we couldn't have done it without her. And then obviously, you know, at the end as well too, just she's such a key player on our team.
I was thinking about Carolyn Harvey, who was the MVP of the Winter Olympics and winner of the Patty Kazmaier Memorial Award. And here she is, she scored what, 200 goals? Career goals, something like that. She's a defender.
Yeah, I think 200 points, maybe 200 not goals.
Points,
but yeah,
I'm 200 sorry, points. 200 yeah. points. Yes, obviously. And she's a defender. What's it like to coach athletes like her?
That's a lot of fun. to be honest, I mean, it's just great. I mean, you have a talented player like that who shows up every day and wants to get better, and She never backs down in practice. I mean, doesn't matter who she's going against, she's competing and trying to get better. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why she's so good. It's just her compete level is so high. And the things that she can do is, I mean, obviously she's naturally talented, but she works at her game. And so it's just, it's great. Yeah.
Another person I was thinking about was Claire Enright, who, after just, I think, a year as a member of the team, she went on to become a three-time national champion and player to score the winning goal against Ohio. How surprised were you? And she had a knee injury that sidelined her after just a year on the team. And how surprised were you that it was her comeback and maybe the one who scored the winning goal in the game?
I don't know if I'm surprised, but I think I was just more completely happy for her. And just, you know, the year that she had that she didn't play because of her knee, and how, I mean, that's horrible as an athlete to sit out and, you know, you're cheering your teammates on from the sidelines and you're rehabbing and you're trying to get back in it. And so she had a heck of a year doing that. And, you know, for her to stay persistent and true and, you know, come back and play. And I think at one point, you know, she didn't think she'd be playing again. So the fact that she can be in a national championship game, have a, you know, contributing role, and then to score the, you know, the go-ahead goal. And I think when she scored, our team was just so excited for her and just couldn't have happened to a better person. And I think once that happened, everyone was like, okay, we got this. We're not going to lose this. And yeah, it's just a really, really cool story.
Yeah. Well, thinking about, you know, here you are basking, I think, in the goal of this latest title, but you're also thinking about what the team's going to look like next season. you know, talk about maybe about who's leaving and how you go about. I mean, you're not just now thinking, oh, we're losing these people. We better go get some more. That's a kind of an ongoing process, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, with any Division I coach, I mean, there's turnover every year, so you're constantly recruiting. It's a job that never ends, to be honest. And, you know, all of us were on the road about 3 days later after the national championship recruiting. I mean, we didn't really have much time to, I guess you could say, celebrate, because life goes on and you have to keep recruiting and, you know, try and fill the voids of all these great players that have left.
Is there any NIL concerns when it comes to women's hockey?
Maybe more specific concerns.
Does it get involved with women's hockey? Let me put it that way.
It's just touching the surface, but we're not really there yet.
Yeah, it's interesting. For somebody who hasn't been to the Laban Arena, where you guys play, I think it's like the second arena that was built specifically for a women's hockey team. Minnesota had the first one.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know the actual fact check on that one, but I would say you're pretty close to that. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
What do you think about the Laban Arena? I mean, as a fan, it is a blast to go there.
Yeah, well, if I'm being honest, I've never been a fan there because I've always been on the bench coaching. So I don't know what it's like as a fan, but I can only imagine. My kids love it. I think if I'm a fan, it's a pretty family friendly environment and a lot of red and white. And we've said it time and time again. We just have the best fans in the country and they show up all the time. And yeah, it's a great place to play.
Yeah, I was with the gals that were right behind us this last match were, I'm sure, former players. And we got we got at the end of the match, Dan Devers turned around and said, "Thank you for giving us this good play-by-play through the whole game." They're pretty well, at least in where I've sat, they were pretty knowledgeable fans as well.
They're invested in that. That's awesome. Definitely.
You know, I think last year I was going to say we can't go on meeting like this, but I think we should, because last year about this time you were on with me, and I hope I hope there's a chance to have the same thing happen again next year. it won't be me because I'm retiring, but I'm hoping whoever the new person is who takes this job gets you back next year. And I think last year we had you on with Joe Cranston.
Yes.
Joe is the head coach at UW River Falls, the Falcons, and they won their third national championship in a row. They won this year, and it's the third one in a row. How is it? I mean, and I'm just wondering, the players, well, there's a couple things going on here. One is the coaching. And I'm kind of comparing the coaching of UW River Falls with the coaches of UW Madison. Joe Cranston has been, he's the only, first and only coach of the UW River Falls. He's been doing it 26 years. Amanda Ryan has been there at least 10 years. Assistant coach Jim Walsh has been there 18 years. And you have a similar kind of thing going on with, you know, talk about your the coaches and their length and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah. We're pretty similar. I mean, I think 16 or 17 years I've been here, and same with Dan. About total for him, I think is about maybe 18. I'm not entirely sure, but yeah, I think there's something to be said with consistency of coaching staffs. And obviously Joe has it going at River Falls. And I'm sure, you know, the longer you stay together as a coaching staff, the better you know one another and can feed off of one another. And, you know, obviously we all have strengths, we all have weaknesses. And I think part of a good coaching staff is, you know, being able to bring people in that have different strengths and, you know, can use their strengths, you know, whether, you know, I have a strength that coach doesn't have or Dan, but we're all utilizing what we're good at, and we know that. And so that's pretty awesome. And I'm sure Joe is doing the same if he's had staff around that long.
Yeah, I think and on the head coach side, you want to, I mean, let your assistant coaches do what they do and do what they do best.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And I mean, Coach Mark is just great, and he's not a micromanager, and we're, you know, we all do our jobs, and he knows at the end of the day we're going to get our job done, and we want to do it well, and we all enjoy working together. That's why we've been together so long. I mean, every morning I wake up and I'm excited to go into the office and see Mark and Dan and our support staff and work with the players, and really that's what it's all about.
The coffee shop I stop at in the mornings on occasion, the guy behind the counter is good friends with many of the women who play, and he's just struck by how nice they are and how excited he is to be kind of friends with them. And I mean, even away from the coffee shop, he still runs around with them a bit. And and that whole kind of team atmosphere is so good, yeah. I think. I mean, for your team and how that gets built. How does it get built?
Oh, it doesn't get built overnight, that's for sure. I mean, it's hard. I mean, in today's society, and just putting others before yourself is not, you know, the natural thing to do in today's day and age. So, you know, obviously there's highs and lows of every season, and, you know, it takes time to come together as a team and know one another. And some of these trials and things that, you know, our team will go through throughout the season, you know, can either strengthen you or pull each other apart. And so we try and use it to strengthen one another. And so, you know, every team is different. Every year is a different year, different challenges. Like this year that we had the Olympic year, and that was a new challenge for us as a coaching staff and the players as well. And so how are you going to handle it? What are you going to do? Things that come up that you don't anticipate, how can you think on the fly? And so it's, yeah, it's, you know, and it's part of the culture that we have here. It's a team first mentality. And players know that when they're coming in, you know, to be a Badger.
Yeah, you really sense that. And in a year like this, or in a year leading up to it, I think the temptation would be among the best players to say, well, I'm going to do a little extra on my own here and make an impression. But I think the team approach is, that's the winning formula.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, we celebrate individual success. I mean,
of
obviously, KK had an outstanding year. And, you know, the year before, Casey O'Brien winning the Patty Kaz. So winning that back-to-back is just so, like, unbelievable, really. And just so cool. And so, you know, we want our players to succeed and succeed at the next level in the Olympics and PWHL. And, but I think the most important is just, you know, the players we're recruiting are really good human beings.
Yeah.
And, when they, you know, when they leave here, they've matured, they've grown, and we just want them to be successful, in whatever they do, whether that's hockey or nursing or whatever, but they leave as, you know, good people.
The other State Journal piece was, our note was that forward Lacey Eden on Monday celebrating rollerblading off the pier at the Memorial Union headfirst into Lake Mendota.
Well, she was wearing a helmet, so that's good.
with her teammates lined along the way.
Yeah, they're cheering her on. It's just something she likes to do, so good for her. I would never do that, but she's a lot younger than me.
Well, I tell you what, you've done a marvelous job, and the team obviously is absolutely wonderful. I hope that who's ever in my spot next year, you know what, win or lose the national championship, I hope they sit down with you, because it's always fun to talk with you, Jackie. Thank you so much for
being with us.
You bet.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it very much. Jackie Grum is the assistant coach of the UW-Madison women's hockey team, former player and a good one, and a really good coach, too. And it was fun to have her with us. Well, we're going to turn our attention to jury duty. Have you? You know, I always wanted to be on a jury, and I never have had the chance because I've never gotten called. Other people apparently aren't as excited about serving. We're going to talk about the ins and outs of jury duty next with the Dunn County Circuit Court clerk next, Katie Shelley. I'm Larry Mueller. Many people, or at least some people, see jury duty as an inconvenience, something to wiggle out of if they possibly can. But, you know, jury trials are, frankly, a hallmark of our constitutional democracy. And serving on a jury is a civic responsibility more of us should welcome. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us as we talk about juries and jury selection and jury duty, with our guest, Katie Shelley, who is the Dunn County Circuit Court clerk. And as we talk with Katie, I hope you'll join in. Have you received a summons to report for jury duty? Have you served on a jury? What was the experience like for you? give us a call. The number 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Katie, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me.
Jury duty, many people, well, some people at least dread being called for jury duty, and you probably have gotten that. I mean, talk about your role in the process maybe first.
Yeah, yep. So each clerk of circuit court throughout the state of Wisconsin each year will request jurors' names from the Wisconsin Department of Transportation through the Office of Court Operations. That's where we get the Wisconsin residents' names to see if they can qualify to serve as a juror. So some counties have to request quite a few jurors' names or individuals' names because I have a lot of jury trials. In Dunn County, we have about 14 to 15 jury trials per year, so quite a bit smaller than the larger counties. But essentially, to serve as a juror, you must be a Wisconsin resident, a citizen of the county, citizen of the United States, a county resident, 18 years of age, and you have to understand the English language. And if you don't meet those qualifications, you do not qualify to serve as a juror. If you meet the qualifications to serve, then normally the clerk of circuit court will mail the juror a summons, and then you would be required to come in for jury duty service. In Dunn County, we summons residents for 30 days. You're allowed to serve on up to 5 different jury trial dates in a period of one time for 4 years. Say there is a 10-day jury trial. If you're selected to serve on that, then you would be done with your jury duty service after that trial has completed.
So, and if I'm not mistaken, I think Wisconsin, when compared to California, let's say, jury trials can run weeks, in California. And maybe that's just because the ones that are the notorious ones are the ones that are always running out for weeks on end. But Wisconsin is, of my recollection, known for relatively speedy trials without a whole lot of, I mean, they're done more quickly, let's say, than the other states.
Yeah, it just kind of depends on the case type. We in our county, we had like a 14-day jury trial. Mm-hmm. So that is quite a lengthy one. But yeah, not normally lasting months like you're seeing on the news in other states.
You know, why do people, I mean, you must get calls from people or saying, I can't serve or I don't want to serve. What are the typical reasons?
A lot of times it maybe doesn't work with their employer, or if they are self-employed, that can be really a financial burden for the individual. Jurors are paid a minimum of $16 per day, or the county board can set the juror's rate of pay at a higher rate. So it is kind of a financial hardship. Or individuals that maybe stay home or are caretakers for their loved ones, that is another burden or hardship for them to serve. Normally what I do is I try to work with the jurors, and we would send a summons for an entire month. And I just ask them to maybe give me 1 to 3 dates that they could potentially serve and have a backup plan available. But there are instances where maybe medically they cannot serve. It might be not comfortable for them, or maybe we can't accommodate them in a way that they would need to have some accommodations made. So that's some of the reasons we see people requesting not wanting to serve.
Yeah. I was thinking about my brother who had some diminished capacities and was called to serve. And I wrote a letter to the clerk and just outlined why it wouldn't be a good thing to have. I mean, he would not be in a position to be able to serve. And I almost threw in there, but I was sure that this was not the normal way things go, that I'd be happy to serve in his place. Just because I've always thought it would be really interesting to serve and be part of this whole process.
Yeah.
Anyway, I didn't hear, but they didn't respond and say, oh, okay, or anything. I just didn't hear. We didn't hear back from them.
Yeah. If your name doesn't appear on the list that we receive from the Department of Transportation, we're unable to swap individuals. But I do have that request quite often of, my spouse would like to serve for me, but unfortunately, we cannot do that.
Okay. Well, you know, the right to be tried by a jury of your peers, it's enshrined in the Constitution.
That is correct.
Why do you think that was important to the founders of our society?
Well, I think it, you know, it's upholds a democratic process by allowing citizens to participate directly with the judicial system, kind of ensures that trials can remain fair and impartial, and it also serves as a checks and balance with the government power, too.
Yeah, I think that plays a role. Well, JP in Fremont, Wisconsin, is up with something for us. JP, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, thanks for having me. And Larry, you've brought me a lot of knowledge and joy over the years. Thank you.
Thank you.
I lived in Waupaca County. I was called up twice and didn't get selected. And then right in the middle of COVID, I had moved a little ways away, but Washera County. We went there, and the courthouse, it was very professional. They had us down in a room where we were all sitting away from each other, and lo and behold, I got selected to be a juror. And as it turns out, it was a tavern owner 3 miles from my house that he had a guy that was a cook for him. Say that the owner had physically assaulted him. So anyway, when we finally got brought into the courtroom, we all had to wear face masks, plastic shields. When we were let out, we had to go back into a room and keep those on. And any which way, we heard all the evidence. We got in there, and I'm not a quiet kind of person, so I just said, we have got to select a foreman, and I go, I volunteer. And the first thing, I had someone taking notes for me, and I said, first thing we're going to do is everyone put on a card, innocent or guilty. And we had 10 not guilties and 2 guilty. So then I just said, we're going to go around this room, explain all your reasonings why. Let's start with having everyone say they completely understand the charges. And the two that had said no, guilty, they didn't really know what it meant. So we had everyone, I said, any questions, anytime. And in a very quick manner, we got them to swing their votes, and we determined that that tavern owner was not guilty.
Oh, well, what a story, JP. Thanks so much. And this process that went through, would that be a kind of a, and this was, of course, during COVID, so different circumstance than what we're probably having right now when we go in. But what about the routine that he described?
Yeah, I would say that is very common. Besides like having to wear the face mask and the social distancing, we're no longer doing that. Of course, if people request it, we can try to accommodate that. But he is correct. Once the jurors get the case and they start to deliberate, they then would select a jury foreperson. And that's all in that jury room. Court staff is not involved with that process. In Dunn County, we show a video to all jurors that report in on that day, and it outlines kind of what they can do in that jury room. But as far as the voting process goes of guilty or not guilty, it's up to the jurors to decide how they want to do that. So his example of holding the card and trying to explain it, I think that is very normal what happens in that jury deliberation room. And each jury might be a little different, but they work through it all on their own.
Yeah, and I liked his approach there, is explaining what the person was really being tried for and the meaning of it, and finding out that two of the people were kind of really didn't understand what the actual charge was in a way.
Correct. During the jury trial, the judge will also inform the jurors. They read a set of instructions called jury instructions. And sometimes I know the courts will give the jurors the jury instructions when they go in the jury deliberation room so that they can actually read it and have that in paper format in front of them. Sometimes that helps if there are some hangups about what the words mean and definitions.
Yeah. Katie Shelley, our guest today, Dunn County Circuit Court Clerk. It's great to have her with us today as we talk jury duty. And I hope you'll join in with your, maybe your experiences as a member of the jury, or why you don't want to join in, or maybe why you do want to join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about jury duty today with Katie Shalley, the Dunn County Circuit Court Clerk. Great to have her with us to talk about the process. And again, you can join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. The I was thinking back to what you said about the length of a trial. You had a 14-day trial, one of the trial. They're obviously, sometimes it's one day it's done. But in a 14-day trial, I'm assuming the jurors went home.
They did in that situation. Some counties would could decide to sequester the jurors, meaning they would stay in a hotel and try to be removed from the public. But that is pretty rare. That doesn't happen often, at least in our county. And I would say statewide, they're not doing a lot of sequestered jury trials.
And jurors are instructed not to discuss the case with outside of the meetings with either their fellow jurors or members of their family.
That is correct. Yep, the court will instruct them of that. It's probably a little easier on a one-day jury trial when you just report in for the morning and then you have your deliberation happens at the end of the day. But for a multiple-day jury trial, you know, the courts will remind the jurors, like, do not go home. Do not discuss this with your friends, family members. Don't do your own research to reach your own opinion. You're only to consider the evidence presented before you is how you can make your determination.
Yeah, that got to be hard to do in a 14-day trial or any day when it's more than one day, for sure.
Correct.
Doug in Outagamie County, we'll go to you. Hi, Doug.
Hey there. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to share that the experience of being on jury duty, it can be exhausting. I was on a case for 2 weeks because it was separated between, like, proving intent, proving, and also, like, proving if it happened. It was like a actual homicide case, a very violent one. So emotionally, it was really, really challenging to get through that. It was quite a burnout. And it's hard because you can't really talk to that many people at all, as a matter of fact. So it was a whole thing. And it's also really hard to sit in a room with people who who have, like, disagreements, right? There's a lot of banter back and forth between, like, what kind of evidence is presented. And at the end of the day, the decision was made, and everybody was swayed one way. That majority was swayed one way.
Yeah, Doug, I thank you very much. And I'm glad you brought that up because it can be take an emotional toll. A long trial like that, or I imagine even a short trial. I mean, thinking about, I've got to decide whether this person or that group is responsible or not. And it could mean jail or fines or something for the other person or the person that we, you know, decide is right. Do you get, post hoc, do you get much of that back from people who have served or maybe not in your case, in your situation?
You know, it kind of depends on the trial. He is very true. It can be very mentally exhausting and emotionally draining on these jurors. I always think that a lot of them are not used to working in the court system and seeing the things that court employees see and hearing that. And it can be quite disturbing. We wouldn't, in our county, we partnered with our Department of Health and Human Services to refer them there if they would like any services. We do ask that they also reach out to their employers if they have any employee assistance programs for any mental health or counseling, if they need any of that follow-up afterwards. But that is a big issue statewide that I know that we're all facing is, what do you do to not cause trauma to the jurors, and how can they have a rewarding experience while making those tough decisions?
Doug, thanks again. Nancy in Eau Claire, what's on your mind?
Well, I was on a jury trial in a murder trial in Rusk County. It was probably about 7 or 8 years ago, and I'd never served on a jury. And didn't know that I got there that day that it was going to be a murder trial. And I didn't get originally picked. They just didn't call my number yet. But then they went through the jurors already, and they eliminated some of them. And then my number was called up, and they asked me a few questions if I had law enforcement in my family. And I said, well, I do. With my son-in-law is a chief of police in a smaller town in Wisconsin. And they still picked me. I was really shocked. But the trial was supposed to be 5 days. We ended up deliberating or having the trial on Saturday. This started on a Monday. And we ended it not until Tuesday. And it was quite a fascinating experience.
Yeah.
But we had our jury foreman, his father was an attorney, and he was a younger gentleman, and he just did a great job and listed all the, if everything fit this charge or that charge. And we voted a few times, and there was a couple holdouts. And then the one gentleman said, he was an older gentleman, he said, well, what if he goes on and kills somebody else? And, you know, you had to explain to him, you can't look forward, you have to listen to the case. And we did find him not guilty. It was self-defense. So that was just quite the experience.
Thank you. And so an alternate, she served as Katie.
Yes. It's up to the court and sometimes the attorneys if they want to have an alternate juror. In our county, it's quite common that we have an alternate serve. They sit through the entire jury trial, but they are not allowed to deliberate and they don't get to make that final decision. The jurors do not know who the alternate is until right before deliberation begins.
Oh, so the person participates.
Yes, they will participate. So if it's a 12-person trial and we have an alternate, we might have 13 jurors serve. And then right before the jury gets the case to deliberate, we would then excuse one of those jurors. They would have sat through the entire trial. One time we had them wait in another room because it was a homicide trial and just keep them there to make sure we didn't know how long the deliberations would take so that we could have a unanimous jury verdict. But some counties do them all the time, and sometimes alternates are only done on multiple day jury trials. It just depends on the court case and the judge's preference.
Yeah. Nancy, thank you again for calling. Melvin in Madison, what's on your mind?
Well, I was wondering, about 26 or 27 years ago, I lived in Texas, and I was called, I was summoned by mail for jury duty, and I was excused because they had several things that you could check to, if you wanted to be excused, and one was a teacher, you were your teacher, so I checked that, and since I would have had to miss class, and I don't remember if I had to give the reason, but I remember checking teacher or teaching, something like that. And they excused me. And I wondered if that would if that happens in Wisconsin.
Yeah, interesting.
It depends on the clerk of court in the county or the judges. So we have the ability to excuse jurors just depending on what their requests might be. In Dunn County specifically, if I have a potential juror who is a student or a teacher and I could have them excuse to serve on a different month that would maybe work better for their schedule. Otherwise, we do ask that our jurors pick 1 to 3 days as it is their civic duty to serve as a juror. So we try to work with them the best that we can, but it's not an automatic guarantee that they would be excused from jury duty service.
Yeah, that was one of the holdups for me, too, as a professor here on campus. I mean, I'd been happy to do it in June, July, and August, yes. But if I'd been called during the semester, it would have been, I mean, there was nobody else to teach my class, you know?
Correct, yeah. Yeah, that does cause a hardship for jurors, and we try to work with them the best that we can.
Mike in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, yes, I'd like a little more clarification on the jurors' rights. I think it's the FIJA, F-I-J-A form, and specifically juror nullification, the one thing prosecutors hate, I'm told, that gives jurors the right to disagree with the law or the way the evidence was gathered. Hmm.
So during the jury selection process, the attorneys and the judge will ask the jurors that are brought into the courtroom some questions about the case, and the attorneys then strike the jurors, and that's how they're making their selection as to who would serve on the jury trial. So if a juror has a concern about a certain topic or an issue, they should bring that to the judge or the attorney's attention during that jury selection process time.
And they're probably not going to get picked.
Yeah, and the court could excuse them, or the attorneys could exercise their striking rights to excuse the juror.
Bill in Oregon emailed to ask if the DOT provides the names for jurors. Is selection limited to holders of Wisconsin driver's license? Does the type of license matter? Real ID versus regular versus commercial and that sort of thing.
To my knowledge, it does not matter on the type of license. It's just having that Wisconsin ID with the Department of Transportation is how those names are pulled per county.
Yeah, and even if you don't have a driver's license, you need a Wisconsin ID in order to vote or do some of the other things. Yeah. And I assume those get taken right along with a regular driver's license.
Yes, that is correct.
Lucy emailed to say she was called for duty a few weeks after her 18th birthday when she was still in high school and completely ignorant of the process. But Lydia showed up, found herself selected to the jury for a drunk driving case. She said it was fascinating, a huge civic education for her, and has given her peace of mind ever since as a citizen that if she found herself in such a situation, she would have a fair trial of our system.
That is great to hear and share.
I think that's absolutely great. Laura in Madison, your turn. Hi, Laura.
Well, hello. Thank you. I have always wanted to be on a jury. I have lived in Madison for 45 years. I have never been called to jury duty. Can you tell me how that happened?
Well, I've lived here longer than you, and I've never been called either, Laura, but go ahead. Why?
It's random.
It's luck of the draw.
Yeah, it really is. I have some residents that get called multiple times every 4 years. Their name is getting selected, and it's the clerk of the circuit court requests a number of people they want to get called in to serve as a juror through the selection process, and the DOT provides that information. And it's just, like you said, Larry, luck of the draw on the names that get selected.
Maybe that's why I've never won the big lotteries. I can't win it at anything here. Gary and Rhinelander, in the last 30 seconds there, 40 or so, he says that in some states they have age limits when it comes to senior citizen eligibility. For most 80 or 90-year-old people, it would be physically or mentally unable for them to serve on a jury. Does Wisconsin have age limitations?
We do not have age limitations. I do know that some counties they just work with the jurors on an individual basis at what that request may be, is if they can serve or not serve, or if they want to excuse the juror.
Well, I'm here in favor of those 80-year-olds, those 90-year-olds. If they're sharp, why not? Katie, this has been the flew by. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. We've all know a little more about the process because of you. Thanks.
Thank you very much for having me.
Katie Shally is the Dunn County Circuit Court Clerk. Thanks to her, and thanks to you for listening. This and all our shows are a team effort. Clara Kniper, Joel Patnaud, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and I hope you'll stay with us. There's lots more in store right through the afternoon here on WPR News.